Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Parenthood. Children get ill and we're told that's a good thing. Catching viruses teaches our children's immune systems how to work effectively, priming them for a healthy, resilient life. But what about when it's more serious, and how do we know when that is? Today I've got my sister and co-founder of The Parenthood, Dr. Kiara Hunt, here to be grilled about common infections and illnesses she sees in children in her GP practice. Kiara, welcome. I guess I'm very lucky because whenever I'm worried, I just get to call you. You can either reassure me or tell me to get to the hospital. But a lot of people don't have that. Well, most people don't have that access. So I think this is a really important conversation, something we obviously start on the bump class. But let's start with sort of basics. We're always told that a good indicator of whether our child is well is whether or not they have a temperature.
Yes, I mean, I think one of the things to remember is that young children will get ill a lot, and they need to get ill because they need to show their immune systems these different bugs so that their immune systems can build up the immunity to them. So when they see them in future, they're not going to get ill from them. So it is really normal for young children to be ill most of the time. And I'd say, you know, new parents coming to me in the first sort of 3 or 4 years of their their child's life, they will say, all of them, they'll say, I was never ill before I had children and now I'm ill the whole time again. Or my child is constantly snotty, constantly ill. And that's just what happens. And then the children grow out of getting lots of infections and the parents have had their immune systems tested again. So they're also stronger for it.
Yeah, I do. I remember the times when I felt that like children's ibuprofen and paracetamol were sort of on my kind of constant weekly shop because I was sort of often using them. And the other day I had to get some and I was like, oh my God, I haven't used this for years. But it is a really good indicator of how when your children grow up a little, it does just become a lot rarer.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, you mentioned about a fever, and I think that's what a lot of parents worry the most about. It's all very well your child having a runny nose or a little bit of a cough, but when they get a fever and you know, their temperature's high and they're hot and not feeling well, then I think it's quite worrying for parents.
And what is worrying? So I know that a normal temperature is, what, 36.8, so around 37.
Yeah.
I typically never worry till it gets to 40. Is that really reckless of me?
Well, I think, I mean, that's sort of probably a reflection of being a doctor's daughter and having a doctor's sister. A 40 is quite high, but it does depend on how old your child is. So as a general rule of thumb, if you've got a child under 3 months old, then a temperature is generally worrying. So anything over 38 in a child, you know, less than 3 months old, that child should see a doctor. The 3 to 6 month period, again, they do get infections, but you want them checked out. So anything above 39 degrees in a child in 3 to 6 months is something to worry about, or at least to see a doctor about. And then after they're 6 months old, fevers are quite common and they're rarely caused by anything too serious. So over 6 months, I'd say don't look so much at the number, but treat the child. You know, you can have a child with 40 degrees who's running around happily, eating and drinking, behaving relatively normally, you know, to worry about them. And you can have a child with 38 degrees who looks really ill and you're really worried about, and you need to worry about them.
So key to have a thermometer that you can use really easily.
Yeah, yes, but also key to treat the child and not treat the fever. And this is something I'm telling my patients the whole time. Is, you know, it's not about the number on the thermometer, it's about how the child themselves are and how they're behaving, and also what your gut instinct is, you know. And that's hard when you're a new parent, because you're like, I don't know what my gut instinct is, but you'll feel it. If you're worried about your child, there's usually a reason you're worried, and you just get them checked out.
Alarmingly, I've heard about febrile convulsions. So when children have essentially seizures through because of a high fever, what is that? And is that extremely worrying?
Well, it's extremely scary for the parents. It's usually not worrying. Yes, it's essentially when the child's response to having a fever is to have a fit, which is like an epileptic fit, but it's not epileptic. It's caused by the fever. Normally, they'll sort of resolve within about 5 minutes. But it is utterly terrifying for the parents if that happens. You've got, you know, a child who's hot and having a fit. So, you know, if it's the first time your child has that, then you'll always, you know, call an ambulance and they'll go straight to hospital to be checked. And a child who's had it once is more likely to get it again. So once you've sort of experienced it and you know how to deal with it, it's a bit less worrying. But you know, the key is to diagnose that's, you know, that's what's causing the convulsion, and then, you know, treat it as necessary. But it's not necessarily a direct relation to a high fever. You can have a febrile convulsion at 38 degrees, or you can have a febrile convulsion at 41 degrees. It's more that the child is prone to have that response to a fever.
And what's actually happening? Is the child's body trying to reduce the fever in some way, or is it just that they kind of can't cope?
It's just a body's response, in the same way that you know, get very hot or you get very shivery, and it's just sort of doing that in overdrive. But it's if it's diagnosed as a febrile convulsion, they'll grow out of it, and it's nothing to worry about. But I think there's lots of things you can do when your child has a fever. And, you know, the old adage of either, you know, wrap up a fever, you know, make the child sweat, or cool the child down by, you know, putting them in a cold bath. Neither of those are what we advise to do now. They can actually make the child's fever worse. You know, cold sponging a child will make those blood vessels that have come to the surface, which are helping to cool the blood down. If you then put cold water on them, the blood vessels constrict and it's harder for the body to lose heat. So you don't want to do that. And again, wrapping a child up has shown to potentially make the fever or the illness worse. So just normal clothes, and you know, you can take a few layers off them if they're hot, but not strip them completely. You don't put a fan on them for the same reason. Give them medicines to bring the fever down if they need it. So again, if they're happy with a 40 degree fever, you don't have to give them a medicine for it. But if they're clearly unhappy, in pain or distress, then you would give them either paracetamol or ibuprofen to help bring that fever down.
And what happens if that doesn't bring the fever down? Do you seek help, or is that
normal? So I think that's one of the reasons that that you'd go and see a doctor, is if your child has a high fever that doesn't come down with medicines and is unwell, then you definitely want them checked out by the doctor or the nurse. Or any, if you're really worried.
And how long is it normal to have a fever for? I mean, is there a kind of period of time if your child's had a fever but they're well that you would then be worried?
Well, you'll often see, if you look at the sort of instructions on all these bottles of Calpol or ibuprofen, you know, don't use this for more than 3 days. And the reason they say that is not because it's dangerous for your child to have that medicine for more than 3 days. It's because by 3 days you want to know what's causing it, and a doctor needs to be telling you what's causing it. Is it just a common cold, or is it something a bit more serious? So most viral infections don't last, you don't have a fever for more than 3 days. So I normally say it's the 3 days that is a sort of cutoff point, where if they're still having fever after that, it's worth getting them checked.
And we've obviously just come out of a couple of years of lockdown, which has meant a massive reduction in colds and sort of illnesses. Mm-hmm. But usually, how often do children get colds?
Oh, goodness. So, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, because we've had, you know, I've got lots of sort of 1, 2, 3-year-olds who haven't been ill at all. And the illnesses that they would have got in their first couple of years, they're now getting in their sort of toddler years, because they haven't been exposed to anyone else. But, you know, pandemics aside, most children who are in a nursery or play school or doing lots of socializing with other children will get, on average, between 8 to 11 separate viral infections a year. So it's a lot when you think that, you know, that could be sort of ill for 3 days, but then kind of runny nose and cough and things for a few weeks after. It can feel like they're ill, in inverted commas, all the time, but actually they're not. They're only ill for sort of 3 to 5 days of that virus, and then they've got this sort of residual symptoms of runny nose and cough, but are well, you know, are going to nursery, are eating normally, sleeping normally, behaving normally, and then that's it's nothing to worry about.
How easy is it to prevent us getting a cold? Or is it something that we shouldn't try and prevent? Should we essentially use the opportunity of toddlers being disgusting to sort of arm their immune system with the information it needs? Yeah. Or should we say, do you know what, let's just dettol everything and...
No, I mean, I think, again, it's slightly age dependent. When you've got a newborn baby or in the first really 6 months of the baby's life, you know, you do want to be a bit more cautious. Their bodies are slightly less able to cope with being ill and having high fevers. But after that, I think, you know, it's detrimental to be a dettol mother. You want to let your children, have exposure to the different, you know, germs, viruses, everything that's around to allow their immune system to build up an immunity to it. So in fact, the pandemic has not been good in that sense, because a lot of children haven't been exposed. But also going forward, you know, we're using masks much more, we're doing a lot more hand washing, we're using antibacterials a lot more, and so the number of infections they're getting when they're younger is less, which means that they'll get them when they're older, or won't have the immunity when they're older, and actually it's also causing problems with them developing allergies later on, much more so than before the pandemic.
And what about coughs? I mean, again, coughs tend to come hand in hand with colds, and they can be seriously annoying because they keep the children awake at night, they keep us awake at night. And then there's, of course, that worry. Well, I find with coughs, they always linger longer than I think they're going to. And I'm just on the cusp of thinking, oh my God, I've got something terrible wrong with me when it eventually goes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something we see. And a lot of people have seen with COVID, it's something that that's sort of well publicized. But even prior to the pandemic, the normal pattern is you're cold for the first few days, your fever, your illness, and then a cough which just lingers and lingers and lingers. And really, the real cutoff point is 6 weeks after the cold, which is a long time. For children, most coughs have gone by about 3 to 4 weeks after the cold, but again, nothing to worry about as long as the child is well with it. If your child has got a cough, 3 weeks after a cold and still getting a bit of fevers now and then, is a bit lethargic, isn't really got as much energy as they normally have, isn't eating well, then absolutely you get them checked. But if they're coughing but perfectly well, you can relax.
Is there anything you can give your children to ease the cough? I mean, does cough medicine work?
Generally speaking, in England anyway, the stuff you can buy over the counter up to the age of 6 is pretty useless. It's all just glycerol syrup, sugar syrup. There are some sort of herbal ones you can buy which are a bit more, have something more than sugar in it. But the ones that actually treat the symptoms are really only available from the age of 6. So there's not much you can do. But you can, what you can do is put a humidifier in their room. That often really, really helps. Sit them, give them a couple of extra pillows if they're, in beds with pillows by then. If they're in a cot, tilting their cot a bit.
Books under the mattress, can't you?
Put books under the mattress or under one side of the, two of the legs at the front. Using the chest rub, the vapor rub can help clear their airways a bit at night. Putting a bit of menthol or eucalyptus on a muslin, put it near their cot, that sort of thing. That can all help, but it's helping the symptoms and the body needs to clear it. Some children will get chest infections and that's different, and that will need antibiotics. But a child with a chest infection hasn't just got a chesty cough, they're ill with a chesty cough.
Is that what bronchiolitis is?
No, bronchiolitis is different. Bronchiolitis is a viral infection that affects mainly little babies and causes them to wheeze and have quite can cause them to wheeze and have quite a tight chest and cause difficulties feeding and difficulties breathing. And that needs, if it's getting bad, needs to be seen by the hospital or the doctor. Although it's often quite mild illness that just causes colds. But that's different. Bronchiolitis is a virus and a chest infection is a bacterial infection that needs antibiotics. But it's pretty rare that a child needs antibiotics for a chest infection if they don't have underlying asthma or something like that. But often people used to think, a chesty cough, like that old kind of smoker's type cough with like green mucus or green snot, is bacterial and needs antibiotics. But actually, lots of studies have shown now that viruses can cause that as well, and it doesn't often need antibiotics.
And croup is something that is a specific viral infection or bacterial infection?
No, viral. So bronchiolitis and croup are both caused by viruses. But the reaction, the body's reaction to it is a certain type of reaction. So for, with croup, for example, they get a real barking sort of dog-like, seal-like cough that's usually worse at night with some wheeze and some difficulty breathing and hoarse voice. And again, you know, because it's their airways being constricted by the inflammation that the virus causes, it can cause breathing difficulties. So a child with croup who's struggling to breathe might need some help in hospital from steroids and things like that. But in a lot of children, it's just they're okay with it and they can manage perfectly well at home with it. So again, it's about treating the child.
And how would you know that your child would need hospital attention or doctor's attention? You know, obviously with croup and coughs, they can sound really awful. Mm. And you've obviously mentioned if they are well, but can you tell if they're struggling to breathe?
I mean, yeah. That sounds like a really... I think two things. One is absolutely trusting your gut and your instinct, and if you're worried, just taking them to be seen. But what you can do is just take their t-shirts off or their bodies or whatever, so that you can actually watch them breathing. And a child, especially a young child that is struggling to breathe, you'll see the skin above their, like in between their ribs, being sucked in with each breath. You'll see, and that's called, you know, that's called respiratory effort. You know, they're putting a lot of effort into breathing. With every in breath, the skin above the ribs is sucked in, or the skin under the ribs, and you can really see, or even the little bit at the bottom of their neck before their rib cage starts. You can see that clavicle being tugged, not really your clavicle, but in the middle between your clavicles at the front, just above your breastbone. You'll see that, you know, being tugged in and out with every breath. And you can often hear a sort of wheezy sound. And with little children, they're unable to feed properly because they can't breathe properly. So all of those would absolutely be signs that they need to be seen sooner rather than later. And in hospital, they can measure their oxygen levels. They can give them oxygen. They can give them treatment with steroids and things if they need to.
And what about sort of green phlegm? And does that, you know, and green snot, does that mean they're really ill? Is that a sign of infection or is that quite normal?
No. As I said earlier, that we used to think that was a sign of bacterial infection needing antibiotics, but actually a lot of children with nasty colds, everyone, all mums listening to this will know that, you know, very often you have a disgusting coloured, you know, snot or coughing up, you know, yellowy, greeny sputum that doesn't mean it's a bacterial infection. It just goes with a normal cold.
And I suppose, you know, trying to take pictures of that snot, because it's not always consistent, is it? And the phlegm, or even, dare I say, keep it before you go to the doctor. The more you can show to the doctor, the better.
Is that right? That's where, because of these, you know, devices that we all have now are actually quite useful. So, you know, if your child is making a funny noise while they're breathing at night, or you're not sure about that tugging we just talked about, or you want to take a picture of their poo or their snot or whatever, then, you know, having that information to show your doctor when you see them is really useful. So, so absolutely encourage you to do that.
Hmm. In terms of antibiotics, I know that, you know, we hear that we use way too many antibiotics and doctors are kind of increasingly unwilling to prescribe them. But will they always make your child feel better, or, you know, should we push for them essentially?
So what people need to understand, which I think most people do, is that antibiotics are not going to do anything to help a viral infection. If an infection is caused by a virus, antibiotics won't help. They're essentially antibacterial. So they're really helpful if you've got a bacterial infection. Now, sometimes you can get a bacterial infection on the back or off the back of a nasty viral infection. So, for example, you can have a really bad cold. The child has a fever for 3 days and so the coldy symptoms get better. But then at the end of that, or a few days later, they're complaining really of a really sore ear, or their cough is getting worse and they still have a fever, or they can't speak or they can't eat because their throat hurts so much, in which case it might be that some bacteria has lodged in one of these places and they're now developing a bacterial infection that would benefit from antibiotics. So it just needs to be assessed by the doctor. But most childhood infections don't need antibiotics. And actually, you know, we have to remember that it's not just because the doctors don't want to give it to you. A, if it doesn't work, there's no point. But B, it does often cause them to have upset tummy. It can destroy the normal gut bacteria. You know, it can cause resistance, where the antibiotics become less helpful going forward. And therefore, if you don't need it, why would you have it? But that's got to be assessed and discussed as part of the consultation.
And going on to ears, ear infections, are they common? Are they more common in the winter or the summer? What causes them?
They're really common, something we see quite a lot of, but some children tend to be more prone to them than others. So some children never get them, other children are absolutely plagued by them. They're different types. You can get outer ear infections, which are more like swimmer's ear. That happens more in the summer, where you've got sort of ear from swimming pools or water from swimming pools or from the sea or from anything getting in the ear canal and causing irritation and infection. And those sort of infections are treated quite well with just drops. But then middle ear infections is when you get a really sore earache, which is really unpleasant. And children will either tell you that if they're verbal, but if they're nonverbal, they'll be touching their ears, they'll be shaking their head, they'll be sort of bringing their head to their shoulder, and they'll have a fever, and they'll just be really uncomfortable. And a doctor can tell very quickly if a child has an ear infection. And if it's a bacterial ear infection, that needs antibiotics. But you can get earache, you know, with a normal viral ear infection with a cold, but that passes as the cold passes. So again, longer than three days or so of fever and earache needs to be seen by the doctor.
And throat, I remember having tonsillitis endlessly as a child, but my children haven't really seemed to have it.
Yeah. So again, if your tonsils are naturally large, then there's more of a chance that they're going to get inflamed by a virus or get a bacteria sort of lodged on them. So a doctor, again, can look quite easily down, or a lot of mums get quite good at this now, looking at their child's throat. And if you see sort of white pus at the back of the throat, then that probably does need some antibiotics. But if it's just red and swollen in its early days of a cold, then again, that can be perfectly normal. So you know, remembering that also children and adults can clear bacterial infections on their own if they're not too bad. So you don't have to jump straight down the antibiotic route. But tonsillitis or strep throat. So the streptococcus is a bacteria that can quite often lodge in the back of the throat. It doesn't necessarily affect the tonsils. It can affect just the back of the throat. And that is just really, really sore throat that spreads quite quickly around the family. So, you know, that sore throat usually without other coldy symptoms. And that also needs antibiotics.
Do children sometimes feel better with the same infection than adults do? Are they better at sometimes dealing with it? I just remember once having strep throat and it was like the worst I had ever felt. And Ludo also had it and didn't even take a day off school.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think children are sort of one or the other. Even when they're really ill, they can be sort of whimpering in your arms 1 minute. And then as soon as the cowpaw kicks in, they're playing Lego again and running around. Whereas, you know, we're just like in bed, sort of feeling very sorry for ourselves the whole time. So children definitely bounce back really quickly. And when they're well, they're fine. And when they're not, they're not.
And when it comes to sore throats, is there anything? I mean, obviously, you sort of ibuprofen and paracetamol, those are two things that are going to take the pain away. But is there anything else you can do to help the pain?
So there are some sprays you can get over the counter or prescribed, depending on how old your child is, that will help numb the back of the throat. So that's quite useful. So before they eat, for example, to help them be able to eat, cold food, cold fluids, that can help.
Ice cream, smoothies, yeah. That kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And do you still take children's tonsils out? It feels again much rarer now than it was.
No, absolutely, yeah, you do. If they're really causing a problem, so if either the child is getting lots of infections and lots of tonsillitis throughout the year, or that they're so big they're causing them to sort of snore a lot or not sleep properly as a result. So there are lots of reasons we take children's tonsillitis. A slightly different way of taking them out now is how we used to take them out, but it still happens. Usually when they're a bit older, not little children, it's usually from about the age of 5.
And raised glands, is that an indicator that they're not well generally?
Yeah. So it's, you know, your glands, your lymph nodes in your neck. Well, actually, there's all over your body, but with colds and coughs, it tends to be in the neck more than anywhere else that gets inflamed. And it's completely normal when you've got a cold or when your child has a cold for these glands to become swollen, because that's where all the sort of all the fighters essentially in the body are accumulating to try and fight whatever's going on.
That's a good sign. If that's what the kind of antibody release is on, kind of extra high alert, then that's a good thing.
Yeah, totally. So we'd expect them to go up, but we'd expect them to go down again after the infection has passed. And if they didn't, that would need to be checked. Because sometimes a raised gland that doesn't go down or is getting bigger despite getting better does need to be looked at.
And if your child's got raised glands but is otherwise well, is that something you just keep an eye on, but not necessarily go immediately to the doctor?
No, you definitely, if your child is completely well and has completely recovered and it's a month or two later and they've still got raised glands, you definitely go and get that checked.
Meningitis. I know that children are now inoculated against meningitis, so we're seeing much less of it than we used to.
So it's part of the routine schedule now in the UK is meningitis B, which is one of the ones that does cause the nasty, scary meningitis. But we still do see it, and there are different types of meningitis. So it's the sort of doctors and parents, sort of one of their greatest fears is a child with meningitis because they deteriorate so quickly. And can become extremely unwell. So that's what you have to always look out for signs of when your child has a fever, and just make sure they don't have any of those signs. So, you know, it's the classic, I think everyone pretty much knows it, but, you know, an older child will complain of a headache, stiff neck, not be able to move their head, not be able to touch their chin to their chest. They won't want to, or they'll be sort of disturbed or distressed by lights, you know, want to be in a dark room. And then later on there, they'll develop this rash, but that's usually quite a late sign, which is the rash that doesn't go when a glass is pressed against it. It looks almost like a bruisey type rash. One of the earliest signs of a sort of worry with a child with a fever is really cold hands and feet, despite being really hot when they're and feeling unwell as well. So that's one of the things I always tell my parents to kind of look out for. But also, you know, not even just with meningitis, but, you know, any type of infection can become more serious. So it's important to, you know, if the child is becoming drowsy or irritable and not getting better with medicines. We talked about breathing difficulties. If they're sort of bluey or dusky around their mouth, especially little children, that's not a good sign. You need to get that child to hospital. Starting to look dehydrated, dry tongue, dry lips, dry eyes, baby's sunken fontanelle, not peeing, no wet nappies, that sort of thing. So all those, you know, whatever the infection is, even if you think it's just a cold, if your child is showing any of those signs, that's something that needs looking at.
And that's presumably, you know, if that's in the middle of the night, it's not, we'll wait till the morning. That's goes to the hospital now with any of those signs mentioned.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's straight to hospital.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, a big part of this is also knowing where you go, you know, where your nearest A&E or paediatric A&E is, rather than starting to sort of Google and work out where you go. You sort of want to know in any place that you spend a lot of time or where you live, where you would go and how you get there.
Yeah, absolutely. Or even if you're going on a holiday and spending a week somewhere, always, you've got young children, always sort of have an idea of how you get them to hospital if they needed to.
And presumably it's sometimes, if you can, just quicker to drive them, they'll be seen quicker rather than calling an ambulance.
I think you can always call 999 and get the, if you're really worried, and get the advice, and they may, it slightly depends on how quickly the ambulance can get to you, how close the hospital is, what the actual problem is. So I wouldn't just drive without calling 999, but it may be both.
Mm-hmm. Diarrhea and vomiting. Again, it feels like, you know, our children often kind of get this. But babies obviously dehydrate a lot more quickly than we do. Would we be worried sooner in a baby or a child than we would in adults?
Yes, definitely. Definitely young children under one can dehydrate very quickly from diarrhea and vomiting. So we, you know, you have to be much more on it with younger children. And also these vomiting bugs that you get, you know, they spread through the family pretty quickly. And so it's often a case of everyone is really unwell with it, or feeling at least really unwell. But the smaller the child or the younger the child, the more you need to sort of be on top of their fluids. And it really is all about fluid management. It's all about, you know, getting as many sips of water or diuretic or milk or whatever it is that they're drinking into them. And often, especially with little babies, it's not a case of giving them lots of bottles because they drink a large amount and then they just vomit it all up straight away. So it's little, and often. And often with little syringes, you know, those little Calpol syringes you get, just giving them every 5-10 minutes a little bit of whatever they're drinking through the syringe can help. So it's I would say don't worry at all about food. I don't care if they don't eat for days, but if they don't drink, that's a real problem.
I mean, typically when children are ill, they just don't want to eat at all. I remember my children, literally, it felt like a week that they hardly ate anything. And I was desperate to get stuff inside them. Is it worth that battle or do you just let it go?
No, for food, just let it go. Absolutely, just let them eat what they want. If they just want dry toast, that's absolutely fine. And they'll catch up on what they haven't eaten once they're well. And you know, the sort of good things that you want them to eat, they'll be able to eat when they're better. So I wouldn't have that fight. But I would concentrate on the fluids. That's the most important.
And would you give them like a rehydration if they're slightly older? Is it better to encourage them to drink a sort of rehydration drink rather than just water when they're a bit older?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But even little babies can have the rehydration, the diuretic mixed with their milk or on its own if they'll take it. So yes, that will just give a few sort of electrolytes and sugars and salts and things into their system, which is good.
What are the signs that a child is becoming dangerously dehydrated?
So it does depend on the age of the child, but I sort of just the list I said just now, which was the sort of, you know, the dry lips, the dry tongue, the sunken fontanelle, for babies, it's about their nappies. You know, if they're having dry nappies, if your baby wakes up in the morning and the nappy is dry, you know, that's something to worry about. They need to be. But if a baby's got diarrhea and vomiting or any illness and has got nice wet nappies, that's really reassuring.
So a couple of things that I don't know, I have no idea what it is. Impetigo.
children are plagued by infections, aren't they, and lots of different types. So impetigo is a bacterial skin infection. It's sort of a crusty, yellowy skin infection that spreads across wherever it is and is very, very contagious. So the children tend to pass it to each other and it kind of has a honeycomb type crusting on it. It's not very pleasant.
But it doesn't happen on the body typically.
Anywhere on the body. Where? Around the face sometimes, around the anyway, it can happen anywhere on the skin. But it's quite easily treated with either antibiotic cream or oral antibiotics.
Okay. And do they usually feel well with it or do they feel
they usually feel fine with it. It's just a bit irritating on their skin.
An illness that should probably be renamed in the 21st century, slapped cheek.
So, slapped cheek syndrome is something that lots of children, babies get, especially sort of younger children. It's a viral infection caused by a virus called parvovirus. All of these infections we'll talk through now, most of them you don't actually do anything about. You just want to recognize that it's this particular virus and you have an understanding of how long it will last and what your child's symptoms are likely to be and just support them with the different measures you would use to support them with any illness. But slap cheek, what they have is they get a coldy symptom for a few days, runny nose, sore throat, maybe a bit of headache, and then they get these bright red cheeks, which is why it's called a slap cheek. And then a few days later, they might get a sort of spotty rash on the rest of their body, arms and legs, which can be a bit itchy. And then it goes. But they don't need a specific treatment for it. And normally, both rashes have cleared within about 2 weeks. But the child is well as soon as that first sort of coldy symptom has gone.
Mm-hmm. And hand, foot, and mouth.
So again, a lot of parents listening to this will know hand, foot, and mouth. It's not the sort of bovine foot and mouth. It's completely different, but it's another viral infection, quite mild, but it causes more blistering rashes. So little kind of blisters that then crust over on the palms of the hand, soles of the feet, often around the mouth, around the bottom. They'll often have a sort of irritated rash around the nappy, sometimes blisters in the mouth. So actually the main problem with that is that if they've got it in and around the mouth, they don't want to eat and drink, and so one of the biggest risks of them getting a bit dehydrated as a result of it. It looks awful, but it's actually not very serious. And they usually get fever and coldy symptoms at the beginning of it as well, as with all these viruses.
And should you isolate your child when they've got this, or could you send them to nursery?
So you don't want to send them when they're ill, because, you know, they're ill and you don't want to be sending them. But it's not contagious, you know, after a few days. So by the time they're better, they can go back into to school or nursery.
But the likelihood is that your other child will get it too.
Quite likely, unless they've had it before. I mean, some children will get hand, foot and mouth and literally get a couple of spots and might have had a fever and a runny nose for a day. And others, it will be awful. You know, they'll have horrid blisters everywhere and not want to eat because it hurts. So it does depend on your child. You may well have a child who's had it, but you didn't know they had it.
And do parents tend to catch it then from their children, or is it something?
Most parents have had it. So unless they are sort of immunocompromised in any way, or they're pregnant and their immune system's a bit low, then you don't usually need to worry about it with any of these viruses. But pregnant women need to be careful about all these kind of childhood viruses that are around.
Yeah. So the next one on my list is an illness which has a name of a sort of Harry Potter-esque villain, scabies. Scabies. That's horrible.
Scabies is an infection of the skin caused by little tiny mites that burrow through the skin and cause a very itchy rash. Again, often palms of hands, soles of feet, and you see these little burrow marks if you look carefully. And you might look just like eczema or look dry skin, but you see these sort of burrow marks. And the key is it's really, really itchy. It's often sort of also in the armpits and the genital areas. So if you've got a child who's constantly scratching in those areas, you want to be checking them. Again, really easily treatable, but the whole family needs to be treated. Again, it's very contagious, especially sharing bedding, sharing towels, that sort of thing. So the whole family is treated for that all the clothes have to be decontaminated and things. It's not very pleasant, but it is relatively straightforward to treat.
Is it something that children get more than adults? Because I have never had any friends tell me they've got scabies. So maybe it's something they're not willing to share with me.
No, it is probably most common in the sort of teenage, university age group, but we do definitely see children getting it. It's not uncommon in young children.
But you have to go to your doctor to get the special cream?
No, you can get it over the counter from the pharmacy.
Okay. And then chickenpox. I remember I was going to chickenpox parties, but now, of course, you can get a vaccination for it.
Yeah, but the vaccination is not part of the routine schedule in the UK. It is in most other countries. It is in America and most of Europe. So actually, they see much, much less chickenpox than we do. So we still see quite a lot of it here. And again, for chickenpox, it's a sort of blistering, itchy rash. So you get little blisters that kind of come in clusters that then break and scab over and then fall off. And once the thing with chickenpox is it's contagious from about 2 days before the rash appears until the blisters are all scabbed over. So often you know you've been exposed to it before you know the child's got it. But it's again, most adults are immune to it unless they've got a weak immune system. You want to make sure you've got immunity if you're pregnant. One of the things they check. And again, it's just you just let it pass. There's lots of things over the counter in the pharmacy that can help alleviate the symptoms a bit. Bit of antihistamine to help the itch. Bit of calamine for the or some sort of itch relief cream.
And do they feel generally kind of wretched when they have chickenpox, or is it just the kind of ugly spots and the itchiness?
They usually feel pretty wretched at the beginning for 3 to 5 days or so of having a nasty viral illness, and then they feel fine with the spots after that.
But then you have to isolate your child, don't you?
Yeah. Well, that's the sort of thing where you can't go on a flight, you can't go to school, you can't, you know, you have to wait. You usually go through the family as a sort of domino effect if the other children haven't had it. So there's usually a long period of time of being isolated as a family with chickenpox.
And are you isolating for a certain amount of time, or is it a physical indication when the child can be released from their isolation?
So it's usually 5 days from the rash appearing or until all the pox have scabbed over and are dry.
And do some children get it really badly and need hospitalisation, or is it always pretty mild?
No, it's usually relatively mild in the sense that I'm not sure parents would describe it as mild when their child has it, because they can be pretty miserable, but it doesn't usually require hospitalisation. But it can, as most of these infections, they can end up with a child in hospital, and it can cause, you know, infections in the brain and all sorts of nasty things. And scarring is one of the biggest problems with chickenpox, is because the pox are really quite big and can be quite inflamed. It's common to get scarring where the pox has been, which is not great.
And is the vaccination as effective as having had and recovered from chickenpox?
Yeah, I mean, the vaccination is two injections. And I think what happens is a lot of people will have one and then forget about it, especially because they're not being called. So if you have them both with the right time period between them, then it's as effective as having chickenpox. You can get mild forms of chickenpox if you've had the vaccine, but it's usually one or two spots. And that's fine.
It's like a little mini booster then, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's stimulating your immune system again.
What's roseola? Am I even pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, no, roseola, another one of these lovely illnesses that most children will get at some point in their childhood. Sometimes some parents might know it as the three-day fever. So children with roseola will get a high fever. It is quite high normally, so 39-40 for 3 days, and then that's followed by this rash, which is quite dramatic, but quite sort of classic for doctors to recognise. And they get this at quite young age. They normally have had it by the age of two.
What's the rash look like?
It's a sort of flat red, sort of slightly raised spots all over the. It starts on the trunk and then spreads up to the face and the limbs. But it's sort of everywhere, so it does look quite dramatic.
And is it itchy?
Not really, no. But they do have the coldy symptoms before, which again is sort of classic with all these infections. But the key is they've had this fever and then they get the rash. And again, a doctor will recognise it pretty quickly.
And that's not scarlet fever?
No. Scarlet fever is a bacterial infection. So it's sometimes called scarlatina. Some people might have heard of that. And it's mostly sore throat. So you get raised glands, really, really sore throat. And then about 2 days, well, a day to two later, we'll get this kind of rough rash starting on the face this time and then spreading to the rest of the body. But that feels quite rough. The rash is quite raised. It feels a bit like sandpaper, the rash of scarlet fever. It's quite uncomfortable. The rash itself isn't contagious, actually, but it needs treating with antibiotics because it's caused by the streptococcus. It's caused by the same type of bacteria as strep throat. But in little children, it causes this scarlet fever.
And what about measles?
So measles wasn't something we saw at all because everyone was vaccinated, but it's something that we've started seeing again now and is much more serious than any of these other ones that we've been talking about. And again, they'll get, you know, it's quite hard because they get similar types of symptoms, you know, the cold symptoms, the high temperature, and then this rash, but they'll often be they'll have quite sore eyes with measles. They'll have a kind of conjunctivitis or like irritated red eyes. And if you look carefully, they have grey spots inside their mouth and on their cheeks, and a specific kind of look to their tongue. A doctor again can recognise it quite easily, but they get quite ill or can get quite ill quite quickly with measles, and then they get this spotty rash which is on the head, on neck and face, and then goes down the body.
And obviously, if your child's been vaccinated, and that this is part of the routine vaccination process, yes. This is the MMR, isn't it?
That they have when they're one, and then before they start school when they're three or four.
So if your child has been vaccinated, it's not something you need to worry about. It's more if your child hasn't been vaccinated or before your child has had their vaccination that you need to be worried about measles.
Yeah, exactly. So children below the age of one won't have been vaccinated. And obviously unvaccinated children aren't protected. So it's worth looking out for.
And if your child has not had their measles vaccine, but they've been exposed to measles, but aren't showing any signs of infection, what do you do?
Well, you just monitor them and, you know, you don't have to worry if they're not ill or they don't show any signs of infection. But it's a notifiable disease, measles, so that they would, you know, the health authorities would know about it anyway.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Chiara. This has either been incredibly reassuring and empowering for people or put the fear of God into the listening.
I think the message really is that there's lots of, you know, there's lots and lots of things that's perfectly normal for your child to get. And the vast majority of them are not going to make your child particularly unwell or particularly more unwell than any cold will make them. And a lot of them have names that are a bit scary, but don't actually mean much because the treatments are exactly the same. They just give you information about, you know, what to expect and what the contagious period is and all that sort of thing. and really remembering that it's not about treating the actual condition or even particularly the actual fever. It's about the child and how well or unwell they are that will help you make those decisions to see a doctor or to have more treatment.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the key is to trust your instinct and know where you would go if you were worried.
Yeah, absolutely. But children are pretty robust. They'll go through have all these infections and bounce back, most of them. So,
and at the time we feel that life is awful and, you know, we're so worried about these infections, and then 2 weeks afterwards we've totally forgotten that they even happened.
Yeah, everything in parenthood and childhood, it's a phase, and you forget about it pretty quickly.
Well, thanks, Chiara. That was very useful. Thank you all for downloading this episode of The Parenthood. You can subscribe, rate and review wherever you found this podcast. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm marina.fogel. But in the meantime, from Chiara and me, thanks for listening. And goodbye.
Goodbye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.